Well, when I refer to Israel in these remarks, I generally have in mind the United States and Israel. It's important, particularly for Americans, to recognize that virtually everything that Israel does is with the decisive support, often direct participation, of the United States. That's economic, military, diplomatic, and not least ideological, the way the issues are framed in the United States, quite differently from elsewhere. And when Washington draws the line, Israel obeys, having no choice. Right now, Israel is facing a pretty severe crisis, in fact, a double crisis, a crisis of legitimation and a crisis of delegitimation. Those are the terms they use. And they're both matters of pretty serious concern. The issue of legitimation is coming to a head in the next few months at the United Nations. Palestine is appealing to the UN to recognize Palestine as a Palestinian state and also to admit Palestine to the United Nations. The U.S. administration is pulling every string it can to try to prevent it, but it looks as if they may do it. That could come up as early as September. If it comes to the Security Council, the United States will almost certainly veto it, as it usually does. The most recent veto was 3 months ago, February, and that one was a kind of an interesting one. It actually got some attention. Most vetoes don't, for one thing, because there's so many of them. But it's rarely recognized how isolated the U.S. is at the U.N. on a whole range of issues. The last one did get some notice because it was a little unusual. The Obama administration vetoed a resolution affirming Obama's official policy. That got some notice. The resolution called for an end to settlement expansion in the West Bank, which theoretically is supposed to be Obama's policy, but the U.S. vetoed it. If you want to read something embarrassing, take a look at Ambassador Susan Rice's explanation. I thought she should have had the dignity to resign. But anyway, she gave an explanation. The resolution also had another aspect. It declared the settlements in the West Bank illegal. And of course, the Golan Heights, which nobody talks about, regarded them, it declared that they're illegal. And it's important to recognize that that's uncontroversial. In fact, Israel itself recognized that back in late 1967. It recognized its highest legal authorities advised it. The Attorney General agreed that any transfer of population into the occupied territories is in violation of the core principles of international humanitarian law, the Geneva Agreements. And technically, the Israeli Supreme Court also recognizes it, but they find various ways around it. It's repeatedly been recognized by the Security Council, and most recently, a few years ago, by the International Court of Justice, the World Court, with the U.S. Justice in a separate declaration affirming the conclusion that this was technically about the separation wall, affirming that any part of the separation wall, it's about 85%, that's there in order to protect Israeli settlements is de facto in violation of international law because the settlements are illegal. So that part's not really controversial. The other part of the resolution was reaffirming official U.S. policy, but Obama decided to veto it. The General Assembly in the coming session is a little different. The United States can't veto General Assembly resolutions, so it'll probably be another one of the familiar resolutions. Again, not just on Israel, on a whole range of topics. overwhelming. It rarely gets reported, but there's vote after vote, which is, you know, 180-3 or something like that. The U.S., Israel, sometimes some Pacific island or something like that. Sometimes it's even worse, sometimes 150-1, the United States. So it'll probably happen again. It probably won't get reported. Recognition of Palestine is already quite overwhelming, including important countries like Brazil, which is the most respected, influential country in the South, other South American countries, and quite a few others. In fact, Palestine is now recognized by about over 100 countries, including about 85-90% of the world's population. That's far more than recognize Kosovo. But in the case of Kosovo, the admission to the United Nations is implemented because there's only one vote that counts in a world that's run by force and violence, not law. That's the one with the big stick. So the United States supports Kosovo, so therefore it's in, whatever the world thinks. And the United States opposes Palestine, so it's out, whatever the world thinks. Well, those are important things to remember. The United States, in fact, is a declining power for a lot of interesting reasons, many of them internally self-inflicted, but it's happening. And it may not be able to hold back the tide forever, even though it's got Canada and a good part of Europe kind of toddling along politely, for the moment at least. In Israel, the government and political commentators refer to the coming votes at the United Nations as a tsunami that they're going to have to do something about. And they're flailing around to decide what they might do. It could be dangerous. It's a unpredictable, violent state with plenty of force behind it. And it has a doctrine. It goes back to the 1950s. The doctrine back to the 1950s is that if we're pressed too far, we'll go crazy. Nishtageya is the Hebrew. Now, back in the 1950s, there weren't a lot of ways they could do that. But by the late 60s, there are. It's a powerful nuclear state. They might do all kinds of things. I hate to think about it, but one possibility is another attack on Gaza. There's bombing of Iran. You know, who knows what they'll do. But something might happen. I suppose they don't know themselves, but so, of course, we can only speculate. That's the legitimation of that Israel, the tsunami is... It took another step forward just a couple of days ago with the unification of Hamas and Fatah under Egyptian initiative. And that's important. The fact that it was Egyptian initiative and it went forward is a reflection of the really quite dramatic, spectacular changes that have been taking place in the Arab world and North Africa in the last couple of months. The Arab Spring, as it's called. This example, the unification, is one of the many reasons why Israel and the United States are deeply concerned about what they correctly regard as the growing threat of democracy in the Arab world. In this particular case, from 1991, the U.S. and Israel have been dedicated to separating Gaza and the West Bank, breaking them apart. That's in direct violation to the Oslo Accords, signed right at the same time, which declare them to be a territorial unity. Well, the unification might impede and might even reverse this process of a separation of the two parts of Palestine, and even more dangerous, the unification might undermine Washington and Tel Aviv's dedicated efforts to prevent any political settlement, any diplomatic settlement of the Israel-Palestine conflict. That settlement, the terms of that settlement are very well understood, supported by essentially the entire world, including Iran, Hamas just reiterated its support for it, virtually everyone to unification. It's been prevented for 35 years now by the United States primarily, and of course by Israel. Again, important to recognize. I'll come back to it. Well, that's basically the crisis of legitimation. There's also a crisis of delegitimation that Israel's facing, and that's the term that's used when you read, say, the Israeli press. That process of delegitimation was carried forward last December when Human Rights Watch, which is a pretty cautious conservative organization, Human Rights Watch, I'll quote, called on the United States to suspend financing to Israel in an amount equivalent to the costs of Israel's spending in support of settlements. So cut back any U.S. support that goes to the settlements, and also called on the U.S. to monitor contributions to Israel from tax-exempt U.S. organizations that violate international law, including prohibitions against discrimination. Now that casts a very wide net for those of you who know the details of this. In the background is also Amnesty International had already called for an arms embargo on Israel, because it's using arms and U.S. arms in violation of international law, actually violation of U.S. law too. In the background is also a popular movement of divestment from anything involving the occupied territories in the United States. Crucially, that includes major U.S. corporations, like say Caterpillar, which provides the equipment for the destruction of the West Bank for illegal construction, also for straight murder, like the Rachel Corrie case. Includes Motorola, another major corporation, which is providing electronic systems for the illegal separation wall, again, uncontroversially illegal, and for the settlements, all illegal, and many others. And this is also extending beyond to broader boycotts. So that's the crisis of delegitimation alongside the crisis of legitimation. And you can see why it's considered, you know, a tsunami, something very dangerous and might elicit a unpredictable and maybe a very dangerous response. Well, there's a good reason why the United States fears democracy in the Arab world. To find out why, all you have to do is to take a look at polls of Arab public opinion. They're certainly known to planners, but they're not published here. And I presume they're not published because the press doesn't want you to know what people think. I can't think of any other reason. It's hard to think of anything more important at this stage with what's going on in the Arab world than what Arab public opinion is. You hear a lot about what the Arab dictators say, but you don't hear about what the public thinks, and that's very revealing. So what is the public? The polls, incidentally, are taken by the leading U.S. polling agencies, the most prestigious ones. They're released by major institutions, you know, Brookings Institute and so on. It's inconceivable that the media don't know about them, and planners certainly do. And they're interesting. So, for example, in Egypt, the most important country in the Arab world, about 90% of the population regard the United States as their main enemy, the main threat that they face. Opposition to U.S. policy is so strong that about 80% think the region would be more secure if Iran had nuclear weapons, not just nuclear energy, but nuclear weapons. Maybe 10% regard Iran as a threat. And the figures are a little different country by country, but that's roughly the story throughout the Arab world. So you can see very clearly why the U.S. and its allies, Israel, of course, and the Western allies, cannot tolerate democracy in the Arab world, not authentic democracy, at least, the kind of democracy in which public opinion would have some impact on policy. I mean, if it did, I mean, you know, the United States not only wouldn't control the region, which has been a primary goal for 70 years, but it would be driven out. And that's no small thing. It's a major concern has been to maintain control of the energy reserves of the world concentrated there. So, of course, the U.S. and its allies are very frightened of democracy in the Arab world. Of course, they talk about democracy, but you know, Stalin talked about democracy too. They can't possibly accept it, and will do anything to block it. And if you look closely at the policies towards the various uprisings, you see it clearly. I could come back to that if you like. You should bear in mind that there's nothing new about this. This goes way back, and there's plenty of evidence about it, plenty of documentation, should be on the front pages of the newspapers, certainly should be taught in schools. So let's go back, say, to the 1950s. In 1958, in then classified, since then declassified documents, internal documents, President Eisenhower, 58, raised with his staff a problem that bothered him. He said he was concerned about what he called the campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world, and not by the governments, which are more or less supportive, but by the people, and wanted a discussion of this. Well, right at that time, the National Security Council, which is the highest planning body, came out with a memorandum in which they analyzed that situation. They said, there's a perception in the Arab world that the United States supports dictatorships, harsh, brutal dictatorships, and blocks democracy and development, and that we do this because we want to maintain control of their energy resources. And it went on to say that the perception is more or less accurate, and furthermore, that's what we ought to be doing, because we want to control it and democracy would get in the way. Well, that was 1958. You can fast forward to 2001, there's plenty in between, but I'll skip it. And you'll recall that right after 9/11, George W. Bush made a pathetic speech in which he asked, why do they hate us, Eisenhower? His answer was, they hate our freedoms. Well, that elicited a study by the Pentagon Research Group, Defense Science Board, which I don't think was reported here, but they essentially reiterated what the National Security Council said in 1958. They said they don't hate our freedoms, they hate our policies. And then they went through it, essentially the same policies, they haven't changed. What they should have said is, we hate their freedoms. And we hate their freedoms for a really good reason. If they're free, we're not going to be able to carry out these policies, and we want them. And we're beginning to see that. There's a doctrine, if it was articulated pretty well by former Jordanian high official, Marwan Muasher, who's the Middle East specialist, the research specialist for the Carnegie Endowment, right during the Arab uprisings. He said that there's a general principle, which is that as long as everything's quiet, as long as the population is under control, then the powerful can ignore the population and can do anything they like. Let's call it the Muasher Doctrine. A very, very wide application. Actually, it applies within the United States as well, rather crucially. So the Muasher Doctrine holds, and therefore, we don't care about the campaigns of hatred. We don't care that they hate us. We hate their freedoms for good reasons. We'll ignore the polls. All of this became pretty dramatically clear here just in the last few months with WikiLeaks exposures. Of all the WikiLeaks exposures, the one that got the most publicity, big headlines, a lot of euphoric commentary, was that the Arabs support U.S. policy on Iran. And that's a core U.S. policy now, isolating, undermining Iran. And the Arabs support us. That was the headline, a lot of clapping and so on. Well, they were talking about the Arab dictators. What about the population? Like I said, the population, about 10% think Iran is a threat, and a considerable majority think the region would be better off if they had nuclear weapons. But under the Muasher Doctrine, it doesn't matter. As long as they're suppressed by the dictatorships that we back or somehow silenced, then we can do what we like. And if the Arab dictators support us, who cares about anyone else? Now, that's strikingly, not just the diplomatic record, that's the press, that's the intellectual community, the whole intellectual community. Just read the commentary on this and see. General assumption, maybe they'd like to have Iran have nuclear weapons, but as long as the dictators are with us, who cares, as long as they're quiet. That's the prevailing attitude right through the whole educated, articulate community, not just on this issue, and as I said, it holds domestically as well, worth thinking about, but different topic. Well, the Arab Spring has had a number of effects already. One of them I just mentioned, Egypt did move forward to bring about the unification that the U.S. is and Israel are quite concerned about, but that's only one thing. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, Egypt, the new Egypt, allowed Iranian ships through the Suez Canal into the Mediterranean. Now, that has first time that's ever happened, and the U.S. and Israel don't like it. The Mediterranean's our lake, not anyone else's, and they broke with that. It looks as if they're going to move to open the Gaza border. The closing of the Gaza border, participating in the Israeli siege, is very unpopular in Egypt, and it looks as if Egypt is taking some steps now to open the border, which would break the siege, and that's critical. In the background is another question, which is uncertain. There is a treaty, Egypt-Israel treaty, 1979, which is also extremely unpopular in Egypt among the population. If you read about it here, there's a lot of concern that they may weaken it or maybe even rescind it. The way it's described here is literally, New York Times, that the treaty is very important because it helps preserve stability in the region. That's a very interesting commentary, because what the treaty does is preserve instability in the region. And that's very clear and explicit. As soon as the treaty was signed, 1979, Israel recognized, it's obvious, but they, of course, also recognized that with a treaty with Egypt, the main Arab deterrent is out of the game. Egypt is the main, by far the main military force, the only big organized military force in the region. So with the Arab deterrent gone, Israel's free to proceed with its policies elsewhere. It's kind of trivial. They can expand illegal settlement of the occupied territories, and critically, they can attack their northern neighbor, Lebanon. And that was recognized right away. You read Israeli strategic analysts, Avner Yaniv and others. They said straight off, look, this is, we didn't like the treaty much, but it has a good side. We're free to do what we like, because there's no deterrent any longer. And right away, Israel planned its invasion of Lebanon a couple of years later, a total fakery about pretext, go into it if you like. And it was no small thing. The invasion of Lebanon in 1982 killed maybe 20,000 people, devastated southern Lebanon, destroyed a large part of Beirut. It finally got so bad that the U.S. was backing it all the way. Reagan thought it was great, but they backed it. However, it got to the point where, even Thomas Friedman, who, and this is going pretty far, he was a reporter in Beirut, and it kind of dawned on him that having bombs drop on you isn't a lot of fun. So he started writing critical comments about the bombing. Okay, now we're at the outer limits. It was becoming really an international scandal. So Reagan kind of ordered Israel to terminate it in mid-August 1982. A lot of horrors happened after that, like Sabra Shatila, it's another story. And Israel, of course, had to obey. They have no choices, even though Menachem Begin, the prime minister, was talking at the time about how Hitler's hiding in his bunker and we got to go after him. That's Yasser Arafat. But the boss said no, so they stopped and went off and did something else, the Sabra Shatila massacre. The treaty contributes to instability in the region, but in the technical terms of U.S. political discourse, that's stability. Stability means something that we like. Instability is something we don't like, literally. So, for example, you take a look at Iran. The big threat of Iran now is that they're destabilizing the region. How are they destabilizing it? They're trying to expand their influence into neighboring countries, Afghanistan and Iraq. When we invade and occupy and destroy those countries, that's stabilization. When they try to expand their influence into the neighboring countries, that's destabilization. And that makes perfect sense if you own the world. And that's and that is the basic assumption of U.S. culture. We own the world. If anybody's in the way, they're doing something wrong, you know, by definition. And, I mean, this reaches such a level that you can even get things like this. A couple of years ago, the former editor of Foreign Affairs, the main establishment journal, James Chase, a liberal, sensible liberal commentator, was writing about the U.S. Overthrow of the parliamentary regime in Chile, installation of a brutal dictatorship, Pinochet dictatorship. And he literally said, reluctantly, we had to destabilize Chile in order to bring about stability. And nobody saw that as a contradiction. And they're right. It's not. We had to destabilize it in order to bring about our rule under a dictatorship, which is by definition stability. So that's what it means when the New York Times and others tell us that the peace treaty is the foundation of stability in the region. It's the foundation of our rule of the region. But the Egyptians may not go along with that, so we'll see. The isolation of the U.S. on these issues is quite significant and should be talked about in a free society. So take, say, Iran again. Iran is the centerpiece of U.S. policy. This last year was called the Year of Iran. And the foreign policy journals, Iran is, the major issue. Story is that Iran is isolated. The international community is isolating Iran. Who's the international community? Well, that's another technical term, like stability. The international community is, of course, the United States, and anybody who happens to be going along with it, like Israel, maybe, or some Marshall Islands. That's the international community, literally. So take a look at Iran. The non-aligned countries, which is most of the world, have been vigorously supporting Iran's right to develop nuclear energy. They've been doing that for years, but they're not part of the international community. The Arab world not only supports the right to develop nuclear energy, they actually go so far as to support Iranian nuclear weapons. So the Arab world is not part of the world, the international community. The leading countries of the world, like again Brazil, the most respected country, they strongly object to U.S. policy on Iran. Turkey, the major regional power, they object to U.S. policy. In fact, Turkey and Brazil recently just worked out a deal to handle the uranium enrichment policy. The U.S. quickly shot it down because they don't want anything getting out of their hands. So they're not part of the international community. In fact, the international community in this case is the United States, Israel, Canada, large parts of Europe. That's the international community. That's pretty isolated. Incidentally, we might ask, what is this Iranian threat that we're so worried about? Actually, the Iranian government's a rotten government, and it's a terrible threat to its own population. But unfortunately, it's not unique in that regard, including our friends. And that's not the threat, because we support governments which are horrible threats to their population. So what's the threat? Well, actually, there's an authoritative answer to that, which, again, would be front-page news in a free press. Every year, the Pentagon and U.S. intelligence provide an analysis of the global security situation to Congress. The last one, about a year ago, of course, had a section on the Iranian threat, big section. So what's the Iranian threat? Well, you can look it up on the internet and find out. They point out that the Iranian threat is not a military threat. Iranian military expenditures are very low, even by the standards of the region. I mean, minuscule as compared with the U.S., of course. They say that they go into his Iranian military doctrine, and they say Iranian military doctrine is strictly defensive. It's designed to deter an invasion long enough so that diplomacy can set in. They say a very limited capacity to deploy force. They talk about the possibility of developing a nuclear capacity. They say if Iran is developing a nuclear capacity, it would be part of their deterrent strategy, deterring a U.S.-Israeli attack. And if any country needs a deterrent, it's Iran. Just take a look at the geography. It's completely surrounded by a military bases of a hostile, violent superpower, and is constantly under threat of attack in violation of the UN Charter, if anyone cares about that. Nobody sane wants Iran to have a nuclear weapon, I don't think, despite what Arab opinion is, but it's possible that they're developing a nuclear capability, we don't know, and if so, yeah, it's likely part of their deterrent strategy. The chances they'd use it are almost zero. They'd be vaporized in 30 seconds if they mounted a missile. But so that's part of the threat, a deterrent. And they do, an Iranian deterrent would limit what the U.S. and Israel can do. You know, if you've got to be careful if somebody can attack you with nuclear weapons. So puts a limit on the U.S. and Israeli aggressiveness and violence, and that's a threat. And the other threat, which they go into, is what I already mentioned. They're destabilizing the region by trying to expand commercial, cultural, and other relations with their neighbors. Well, that's the Iranian threat. And on this, the U.S. is quite isolated. The U.S. can sort of tolerate with dismay Turkey's disobedience, but there's another country that's much more worrisome. That's China. China doesn't take any nonsense. China is regarded as a great threat by the United States because they refuse to be pushed around. Their sense, China is, we've been here for 3,000 years, fending off the barbarians, and okay, you want to make noises, that's your business. We're not going to pay any attention. And that's really frightening. Like if you're, say, the Mafia Don, and somebody says, I'm not going to pay any attention to you, and you can't do anything about it, you're in trouble. And that's the problem with China, not Chinese aggression. It's just disobedience, disdain, in fact. And if you look at the Washington pronouncements, there's a kind of a touch of desperation in them. So the State Department recently on Iran issued warnings to China saying, if you want to be admitted into the international community, you know, us, then you have to meet your international responsibilities. And your international responsibilities are to obey U.S. sanctions. Well, U.S. sanctions have no validity whatsoever, except that the U.S. is a powerful state and can smash people up. But China is observing U.N. sanctions, which are mostly toothless. And the U.S. is condemning them for that. They say, well, yeah, they're not meeting their international responsibilities. Well, you know, China just laughs. They don't care if the U.S. Is unhappy that they're not obeying meaningless U.S. sanctions. As in many other cases, the U.S. is, most of the world is just refusing to go along. Well, that's part of the reason why the U.S. is in fact a declining power, but there's much more to it than that. However, that's not the topic. Well, let's return to Israel-Palestine specifically. There are mentioned a few crucial moments of recent history. There's a lot to talk about. The most important real turning point was 1967. It was in 1967, with the 1967 war, that U.S.-Israel relations were solidified in pretty much their current form, a big change from before, and a new framework was established in the region. So what happened in 67? Well, in the background was a war that was going on between radical Islamism and secular nationalism in the Arab world. Radical Islamism is centered in Saudi Arabia, the most extreme fundamentalist Arab state, most Wahhabism, most extreme form of Islam, the supporters of jihad, the missionary movement, and so on. That's centered in Saudi Arabia. So that's radical Islam, the core of it. At that time, secular nationalism was centered in Egypt, Nasser's Egypt. There was a war going on between Saudi Arabia and Egypt, a kind of a proxy war in the Yemen, and it was serious. The United States and Britain have traditionally supported radical Islam, almost always. Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, you know, supported the formation of Hamas. It's very consistent. The U.S. has been a very strong, Britain too, a very strong supporter of radical Islamism. And there's a reason, because they consider it a barrier to secular nationalism. And secular nationalism is the real threat, not only in the Middle East, but everywhere. For example, secular nationalism might involve a move towards real independence and towards taking over the resources of the region and using them for its own population instead of for the West and for, you know, the ruling gangsters. And that's a threat. So very consistently, the U.S. And Britain have supported radical Islam, Israel too. In 67, Israel effectively destroyed secular nationalism. That was the main outcome of the war, and defended Saudi Arabia, defended radical Islam. And that was a big plus for U.S. policy. And relations with Israel changed almost totally at that time, militarily, diplomatically, ideologically, you know, in all kinds of ways. Well, that was continues, but after that, in 1970, a couple of years later, the Jordan, U.S.-backed dictatorship in Jordan, was carrying out a real massacre of Palestinians. Black September, it was called. It looked for a while as though Syria might intervene to prevent the massacre. The U.S. was pretty upset about that. That the U.S. at the time was completely bogged down in Southeast Asia. It had just invaded Cambodia. You know, things were totally impossible. Couldn't do anything. It called on Israel to react. Israel mobilized its quite formidable military forces. Syria backed off. Now, that was considered a positive step in protecting the Hashemite monarchy and also the Saudi Arabian monarchy. And in fact, the U.S. aid to Israel quadrupled, practically quadrupled that year. And so it continued. In the Nixon was president then. There was a Nixon doctrine, so-called. And the Nixon doctrine was that the way that the U.S. ought to have surrogate states carrying out the dirty work. Couldn't do everything by ourselves anymore. And in the Middle East, there had to be what were called cops on the beat. The cops on the beat who keep the place under control had to be non-Arab. They'd do a better job killing Arabs. So Pakistan, Iran, which was then under the Shah, Turkey, Israel, they're the cops on the beat. Police headquarters, of course, is in Washington. And there's a branch office in London. That's essentially the way you run the region. And Israel was joined as one of the cops on the beat at that time. And that's stayed pretty much like that. It became critical in 1971. It was one of the most important moments in Israel's history, I think. In 1971, the new president of Egypt, President Sadat, offered Israel a full peace treaty. Nothing for the Palestinians. The Palestinian issue hadn't really reached the international agenda then. So Palestinians, some words about refugees. The quid pro quo was that Israel was to withdraw from Arab territory, and in fact, Egypt only cared about Egyptian territory, the occupied Sinai. Actually, Jordan came along a year later with a similar proposal, withdraw from the West Bank. Well, Israel had a choice at that point, a crucial choice, and they made a fateful decision, I think. They could have had almost total security. A peace treaty with Egypt and Jordan, nothing for the Palestinians, the Syrians out of the game. That's essentially as much security as you can get in this world. the alternative, and they had to decide, do we want security or do we want expansion? Well, the primary expansion at that time was into Egypt. It was into the Egyptian Sinai. Israel at that time was driving thousands, tens of thousands of Bedouin farmers out of the Sinai. They were laying plans to build a big city, on the ocean, a million people, a lot of settlements and so on. And they decided they'd rather have expansion than security. The question is, what would the U.S. do, as always? And the U.S. went along with them. Kissinger supported that. This is what he called stalemate in his memoirs. No negotiations, just force. Well, that had a lot of consequences. One consequence, it led to the 73 war, which was a very close thing for Israel. Another is it set the stage for what amounts to, I don't have time to go into the details, but since then there's been an essentially permanent choice of accepting expansion over security. Israel could have security right now, accepting the international consensus, but they want expansion. And now it's primarily into the West Bank and the illegally annexed Golan Heights, which people don't talk about. The Security Council declared it illegal, but the U.S. didn't care, so Israel does it. And that remains the situation. Well, that was 71, 72. In January 1976, the major Arab states, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, neighboring states, brought a resolution to the Security Council calling for a two-state settlement. By then, the Palestinian issue had reached the international agenda. So they called for a two-state settlement on the international border, the recognized international border, so-called Green Line. And then the resolution added the standard wording of the major diplomatic documents, UN 242, recognition of the rights of every state in the region to live in peace and security within secure and recognized borders. It's basically the resolution. The U.S. vetoed it. Vetoed a similar resolution in 1980. The Security Council's ruled out, shifted to the General Assembly, and then you get these annual votes with, 151-3 and so on, year after year. The most recent one is February. The next one will be this winter session, very likely. Well, that's, meanwhile, settlement expansion continued. And the Oslo agreements came along in 1993. It was a total disaster for the Palestinians, quite predictively. I don't say it in retrospect, I just wrote about it immediately because it was obvious. The pace of settlement increased steadily right through the 90s. Actually, the peak year was year 2000, Clinton's last year. Gaza was closed off, separated from the West Bank in violation of the Oslo Treaty, and that's been U.S.-Israeli policy since. I'll quote Amira Haas, one of Israel's leading journalists, wonderful journalist, and also their main specialist on Gaza. She's lived there for years. And she writes that the total separation of the Gaza Strip from the West Bank is one of the greatest achievements of Israeli politics, whose overarching objective is to prevent a solution based on international decisions and understandings and instead dictate an arrangement based on Israel's military superiority, and the U.S. backs it. That's very bitter. It means that students in Gaza, for example, can't go a couple of miles at the universities in the West Bank. Patients who have to go to a Jerusalem hospital are pretty much barred. People can't visit their families a couple of kilometers away. Meanwhile, repression intensified and Gaza was reduced to misery. Well, in 2005, came the famous disengagement. Israel had about 7,000 settlers illegally in Gaza, using a large part of the meager resources and land, maybe 30-40%. And defended by a big mass of the Israeli army. And General Sharon, who was prime minister, the most hawkish Israeli leader, he recognized rationally that it just made no sense to keep a small number of Jewish settlers in Gaza which by then had been utterly devastated. It used to be a pretty wealthy place, but totally destroyed by then. So that was pointless. It made a lot more sense to take them out and send them to settle illegally in the West Bank, which Israel wants. So that was the disengagement, but you couldn't present it that way. So a farce was enacted, a really comical farce. If Israel, they could have just done it very easily. They could have just said, you know, on August 1st, the IDF, the army, is going to withdraw from Gaza. And at that point, the 7,000 or 8,000 settlers would have climbed into the lorries that were provided for them and be taken from their illegally subsidized homes in Gaza to their illegally subsidized homes in the West Bank. And that would have been the end of it. But that was no good. You had to have a PR operation. So what they staged is correct, was a confrontation. So you get front page newspaper pictures, you know, of a little boy pleading with the army not to destroy his home and so on. And then the cries of never again, you know, Holocaust, we have to stay in West Bank forever. I mean, it was such a transparent farce that it was ridiculed in Israel. And what made it even more of a farce was it is a replay of something that was done a couple of years earlier when they had to withdraw from Yamit, finally, the Sinai. But it passed. The Western press accepted it. And that's a model for what could happen in the West Bank if the U.S. takes a stand. Well, that was the disengagement. Now, the best description of what happened next is from two of Israel's leading commentator, historian Idit Zertal and Akiva Eldar, his main diplomatic correspondent. Now, they write that after Israel withdrew its forces from Gaza in August 2005, the ruined territory was not released for even a single day from Israel's military grip or from the price of the occupation that the inhabitants pay every day. Israel left behind scorched earth, devastated services, and people with neither a present nor a future. The settlements were destroyed in an ungenerous move by an unenlightened occupier, which in fact continues to control the territory and kill and harass its inhabitants by means of its formidable military might, which can be exercised with extreme savagery, thanks to us, thanks to firm U.S. support and participation. Well, the attacks continued. That was August 2005. The Israeli-U.S. attacks continued. They escalated in January 2006. In January, the Palestinians did carry out a major crime, in fact, maybe the worst crime they ever carried out. Now, they had a free election, and they voted the wrong way. That's not allowed. The U.S. reacted instantly. Go back and look at the newspapers. Within days, the United States announced harsh punishment of the Palestinians. Israel, too, of course. Europe kind of went along as usual. So, and in fact, what Zertal and Eldar described picked up significantly then. I won't run through all the details, but there were repeated escalations. In June 2007, Hamas, which won the election, what's described is that in June 2007, there was a civil war in which Hamas drove out Fatah, the U.S. favorites, and that showed that they're just a gang of terrorists. What actually happened is really not contested. The U.S. Tried to initiate a military coup to overthrow the results of the elections. Now, that's standard operating procedure. The U.S. does that all over the world. So they tried a military coup. It was run by a Fatah strongman, Mohammed Dahlan. The coup was preempted by Hamas, and they drove out the Palestinian Authority, and they did take over. Well, that's the Hamas crime. Not that they're nice people. It's a harsh, brutal organization. I wouldn't want to live under their rule, but that's a separate story. And of course, the attacks then escalated again. The siege tightened. In June 2008, there was a truce called between Israel and Hamas. And it's very important, actually. In 2008, there was a ceasefire, basically. So no Hamas rockets. Israel would call off the siege. Notice, a siege is an act of war. Israel, of all countries, insists on that. Israel has launched two major wars, 56 and 67, on grounds that it was very partially blocked from the outside world, very partially through the Straits of Tehran. A total siege is, of course, an act of war. So the terms of the truce were Israel would call off the siege, Hamas would stop rockets. Well, Hamas lived up to that 100%. You can read it in the official U.S. Israeli records. They concede that during the period of the truce, there wasn't a single Hamas rocket. Israel never accepted the truce, maintained the siege. That was June 2008. In November 2008, the day of the U.S. election, you know, when everybody's paying attention to that, Israel invaded Gaza, sent in troops, killed half a dozen Hamas militants, meaningless pretext, and then rocket firing started again. And it went up and back. There were all the deaths, as usual, were Palestinian, but it did continue until December. In late December, Hamas offered to renew the truce. The Israeli cabinet considered it and rejected it. They had a choice then. They could have had a truce, no rockets. They would have had to weaken the siege. But they decided to reject it and instead invaded Gaza with U.S. support. That was the December 2008, January 2009 invasion, which you know about or should. The U.S. supported the invasion, as always, U.S. weapons. U.S. intervened at the UN to prevent a ceasefire. Obama had been elected, but he hadn't taken office. But he wouldn't say a thing about it. His line was, there's only one president, so I can't say anything. President is Bush. He was saying things about all kinds of other topics, like Pakistani terrorism and so on, but couldn't say anything about this, a U.S. attack on Gaza, which was destroying it. Attack was very carefully calibrated so that it would end hours before the inauguration. And it did. That saved Obama the necessity to say anything about it. Now he was the one president, but it had stopped. So he could give the usual story about let's forget about the past and look forward to the future and so on. Very convenient story for those who hold the clubs. Others don't like it much. Right after that, Obama gave his first and, in fact, only major speech on Israel-Palestine. It was an interesting one. He made one good move. He appointed George Mitchell as his negotiator. It was a sensible move. However, he immediately undercut it by making it clear that Mitchell would have no authority. The way he did that was clever. Clever enough so that the press and commentators could pretend they didn't understand it. What he said was, take a look at it, about January 28th, something like that, 2009, roughly. He said, there's now a great chance for peace. We ought to move forward for peace, peace process. He says, there's a constructive plan on the table, the Arab peace plan. He said, finally, the Arabs have come along with the plan. Actually, they came along with it and 1976, but let's forget about that. But now the Arabs have come along with a plan, and their plan calls for normalization of relations with Israel, and he called on the Arab states to move forward with their plan and normalize relations with Israel. Obama is an intelligent, literate person. He can read, Harvard degree, and so on. He knows perfectly well that that's not what the plan said. The plan reiterated the international consensus on a two-state settlement and went even beyond it. It said, once that's established, we should move on to normalize relations with Israel. Well, Obama carefully omitted the guts of the plan and said normalize relations with Israel. Now, that's his way of telling the world we're not going to do anything. We're going to block peace, which is exactly what it meant and exactly what happened. Settlement expansion continued. Obama claimed to be opposed to it, but he made it very clear to Israel that the opposition didn't mean anything. He was asked, his spokespeople were asked at press conferences, are you going to do anything if Israel violates your demand to end settlement expansion? He said, no, this is just symbolic. In other words, Mr. Netanyahu, go ahead and do whatever you like. He was asked specifically, are you going to do what the first George Bush did? First George Bush did impose very mild sanctions when, if Israel violated its demand that they not expand sanctions. Clinton ended them. But Bush said, Obama spokesman said explicitly, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do what Bush did, just symbolic. So it's a clear statement, go ahead and expand the settlements, which is exactly how it was understood. Meanwhile, George Mitchell was kind of displaced by Dennis Ross. Ross comes straight out of AIPAC. He was Clinton's negotiator. His position, as he says, is there's an asymmetry between Israel and Palestine. Israel has needs. Palestine only has wants, so therefore we can dismiss them. That's the neutral negotiator. He's now the leading advisor. Then comes a series of steps up to the veto of the UN resolution last February. The Arab League, meanwhile, they do talk. They actually have voices. They don't say much, but they do say some things. Like a couple of months ago, they called for two no-fly zones. You heard about one of them. They called for a no-fly zone in Libya, and a big uproar about that. Great, no-fly zone in Libya, we got to bomb Libya because the Arabs demand it. They also, at the same time, called for a no-fly zone over Gaza. Not a word, you know. Actually, you can read about it. You can read about it in the London Financial Times, the main international business journal. Someone around the corners in the United States, you could read about it, but no national press. That no-fly zone over Gaza didn't conform to U.S. policies, so therefore that one didn't exist. Let's go on to what the options are now. What are the options today? Well, and there's a lot of commentary about this, of course, and the way it's usually phrased is that there are really two options. One is the two-state settlement, which has been the international consensus for 35 years. You know, you can argue about this and that detail, but the base framework of it is understood. That's one. And the other option that's proposed is that Israel should take it all over, take over the whole territory, and then there'll be a civil rights struggle, like kind of an anti-apartheid struggle. And actually, that's a position which is argued for by a lot of supporters of the Palestinians. They say that would be even better than two states, because then we could have an anti-apartheid struggle. Now, that's a real delusion. Those are not the two options. There's a third option. The third option is that Israel and the U.S. will continue doing exactly what they're doing right now. What they're doing right now is implementing a version of what used to be called the Sharon Plan, after General Sharon, you know, big expansionist, and namely Israel takes what it wants in the West Bank. And we know what it wants. It's not a secret. It wants everything behind the separation wall, which is in fact an annexation wall. That's arable land, water resources, the nice suburbs of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and some big highway system connecting them and so on. So they'll take that. They'll take what's called Jerusalem, which is far bigger than anything that was ever called Jerusalem. They've illegally expanded Jerusalem, illegally annexed it over Security Council orders. So they'll take Jerusalem, which cuts out a big piece of the West Bank. And they'll take the Jordan Valley, from which Palestinians are being mostly evicted and settlements are being set up. Now, that imprisons what's left. It's separated from Gaza, so no outlet to the sea or anything like that. And then they're cutting the corridors through what's left. There's a big corridor that goes east of Greater Jerusalem, goes almost to Jericho, essentially bisects the West Bank, a big town, Maale Adumim, being built there, mostly under Clinton, though it started in the 70s. Corridor up north that goes through Ariel, another town, and another one above that goes through Kedumim, still another town. It's essentially, breaks the remaining parts of the West Bank up into almost non-contiguous and unviable cantons, big infrastructure projects to so that you know, Israelis and American visitors can drive through the whole area, you know, never even seeing a Palestinian, maybe some figure on a hill, you know, with a goat or something. The tourist office probably funds them, you know, looks good. But that's it. And the Palestinians can just rot. Not entirely. So like in Ramallah, the U.S. And in fact, Europe mainly are funding a kind of an island of affluence. So you live in Ramallah, you know, you have nice restaurants, and concerts, and so on. That's the standard neocolonial program. You go to any third world country, any miserable colony, you can find islands of affluence and, you know, glamour and so on beyond what we have. That's for the elites, and that shuts them up. And meanwhile, the rest just collapses. They can leave if they want. Well, that's the third option, and that's the one that's being implemented. So we don't have to speculate about it. It's being implemented. You're paying for it, or your parents, if you're not old enough to pay taxes. And that's what's going on before our eyes. So that's the real option. And the choice is that or two states. There is no third option at this point. You can think in the longer term, you know, maybe down the road there'll be something better, but there's got to be a first step, and the first step is two states. There's no other proposal. It's now argued very commonly that that's impossible. The settlements have gone so far that it's impossible. Well, the world doesn't agree. That's why you had the February resolution. The world thinks it's possible. The Palestinians think it's possible, both factions, Fatah and Hamas, which again reiterated its support for it. So I think there's reasons to believe it is possible. What's crucial is, as always, what the U.S. will do. If the U.S. if the U.S. joins the world, it'll be possible, and Israel will go along because they don't have any choices. And we can do things about it, like we can stop participating in the crimes. That's not a major, you know, unimaginable action. Stop participating in the crimes, along with what, say, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and others are calling for. That would make a difference. Now, there's a lot of, it's very common now these days to draw analogies between Israel and South Africa. Most of them are pretty dubious in my view, but there are some which are reasonable and instructive. Oh, okay. Yeah. It says 5 minutes. I'm used to that. When my kids were little and they asked questions, you know, they often say, just the 5 minute lecture, please. So now you're going to get the 5 minute lecture. There's one analogy between Israel and South Africa, which is very real and never discussed, probably because it's real. Around 1960, the South African government, nationalist government, recognized that they're becoming an international pariah. And the South African foreign minister called in the American ambassador. We have the documents now. And he talked to him. He said, look, we're getting voted down by everyone in the UN. Now everyone's opposed to us and so on. But you and I both know that there's only one vote in the UN, yours. So as long as you're with us, we don't really care what the rest of the world thinks. And that's pretty much what happened. If you look through the following decades, by the 19th, a big anti-apartheid movement did develop. By around 1980, American corporations were pulling out. Congress was passing sanctions. The UN had already declared an embargo. Nobody was supporting apartheid. It was overwhelming opposition. But the only person who was supporting apartheid was Ronald Reagan and his administration. They were strong supporters of apartheid, and they continued to support it in the framework of of the war on terror. War on terror was declared by Reagan, not Bush. And they had to defend the African nationalist apartheid regime against the terrorist Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress. and I mean it literally. In 1988, the White House declared the ANC, Mandela's ANC, to be one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. So, of course, we had to support the white nationalist regime. In fact, Mandela himself only got off the terrorist list about 2 years ago. So now he can come to the United States without a special special arrangement. And that continued until around 1990. At that point, U.S. policy changed. We don't have all the documents, but you can guess why. Mandela was let out of Robben's Island. A couple of years later, apartheid was gone. It's not a nice situation. It's a pretty rotten situation in many ways, but at least apartheid was dismantled, which is a big victory. Now, that's not the only time that that's happened. There's case after case. When the boss lays down the law, people have to do something. And that's actually an optimistic conclusion for us. It means that it's really very much in our hands. If we take the right kinds of actions, if we're capable of, if our own society is democratic enough so that popular opinion makes a difference, which it should be, and if it isn't, we have a lot to worry about, not just this, then plenty of things we can do to change that, to compel the United States to join the world on this issue as well as others. And in that case, this Israel-Palestine conflict can be certainly mitigated, not solved, but mitigated and laid, set on the basis to a much more favorable outcome. That's the 5-minute lecture.